Hi, everybody, and welcome to Stack Trace. This is the podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives. And those two developers are me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo?
I'm doing great, John. How are you?
I'm doing great as well. In fact, we have something to celebrate today, right? Ooh. We have hit a big milestone with this show, I would say. It's definitely not something that I kind of expected as we got started, because of course, when you start anything, you don't know what's going to happen, right? Like what's the future going to be for this project? And as we record this 195th episode, it is actually StackTrace's 5th year anniversary. We've been doing this show for 5 years, Rambo. Can you believe it?
Yeah, it's amazing. I just read, I think this weekend, our friend Casey Liz was talking about the 10 years of ATP. And I was thinking, wow, 10 years, that's a long time. And I pretty much remember when they got started and I started listening to them. And yeah, I thought 10 years was a long time, but 5 years is also quite a long time. And it's amazing that we've been doing this for so long. And I think we're probably going to keep going for a little while longer, because this is a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is really a lot of fun. And even though we have reduced slightly the amount of episodes that we do, like every month or in every year by extension, we definitely want to keep the show going, because both of us, we really love doing it. And of course, we love hearing from people who are listening to the show, and people seem to keep dialing in and keep listening. And that's always really, really awesome. So definitely it's something we want to keep going with, even though we might, you know, sometimes do more episodes, sometimes do a bit fewer episodes, depending on both of our schedules. But we definitely love to have the show going. And it's also been great the way we've been able to evolve the show over the years, I think, where, you know, we started out talking more or less only about like Apple news and rumors, and of course, from developers' perspectives. But now it feels like we've kind of kept changing what the show is about while still keeping the focus on the technology. And now we're able to talk more about kind of our own work and learnings from it and so on, which I personally really enjoy, like having that kind of every month or twice every month conversation with you about our work and kind of, you know, where we're going from here.
It's kind of like a technical therapy session of sorts.
Exactly. It's really, really perfect. So yeah, happy 5 year anniversary, Rambo. It's really, really exciting.
Yeah, happy anniversary. So what are we talking about in this special episode?
So we thought about it, right? Like, what do we do to kind of celebrate this milestone? And we came up with something that I think is going to be a fun topic to talk about, kind of related to this 5 year mark. And that is kind of reflecting a little bit about how have we changed the way we work during the past 5 years, both kind of from a routine perspective, if you will, or like the way we work and maybe structure our work and so on, but also like how has the technology we use actually changed during the past 5 years, which of course, with technology moving so quickly, it has changed quite a bit, right? In the past 5 years, both in terms of the programming languages we use and the technologies and the tools and the devices we use and so on and so forth. So it will be fun to kind of reflect back to talk about how have things basically changed for us in terms of technology, in terms of our work since we started the show. And then after that, it would be really fun to talk about what do we think might change in the next 5 years. So when we do have that 10-year anniversary, which I hope we will have in 5 years, what will we talk about then, right? Like, what will that 5-year review look like then? So just kind of looking back at the past 5 years and looking forward to kind of see how has technology been changing for us personally.
Awesome.
So Rambo, do you want to kick things off? What would you say are some way that kind of you have changed your work or the way you use technology has changed during this past 5 years?
So one of the things I was thinking of is more a general thing of how people change the way they look at technology a little bit. And of course, this doesn't apply to absolutely everyone. That would be very difficult to happen, but I think in general, people are more aware now than they were 5 years ago of what I call the algorithm and what people also call the algorithm. And I think that's been, in general, I think a change for the better. Unfortunately, there's a lot of like the algorithm is tossed around as this evil thing that companies use to manipulate you. And it's not as simple as that, but I think in general, people have been more aware of how their biases might affect their perception of things, and also how the way content is suggested for them on platforms. And this is mostly relevant to like social media type platforms, but it can apply to other situations as well. And they've been more aware of what's happening there, and that there is this thing called an algorithm that is programmed to keep them browsing and watching and reading or whatnot. And I think that's in general a change for the better. And I myself have been more aware of that, and not like trying to escape the algorithm, but just being aware that that's a thing and that it can affect your perception sometimes.
Yeah, I think that's a very healthy thing to think about. So like, you know, these messages we get from social media and the content we get presented with, why are we being presented with it, right? Because sometimes it can be one of those things where you might get really upset about something, or you want to really engage with something, but then you kind of catch yourself, oh, maybe this is just something that was meant to kind of be inflammatory or something, right? Meant to kind of cause that reaction. And then you can have like a different kind of relationship with those kinds of posts and articles, right? Like, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, when it comes to technology specifically, like there are all these articles out there that are like, you know, these five different things and you won't believe which number four is, and so on, right? Like this kind of clickbait style articles. Like, I feel like that's related to this topic. Is I feel like that's another thing we've all become more aware of when something feels like clickbaity or something like that, and versus when it's something that is kind of worth your time and worth engaging with, so to speak.
Yeah, right. And I think in general, that's a really good change. And it makes people who are putting this content out there and the companies that are doing these recommendations and things like that more responsible for what they're doing. And it's fun to see like when some like YouTuber or like a website has one of those clickbaity titles and they get called out for it. People notice that these days, and I don't think they notice this as much 5 years ago. So I think that's great that people are aware that this is happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like another trend here that is also very related is the whole privacy debate, right?
Right.
It feels like 5 years ago, we were definitely starting to talk a lot about kind of internet privacy and you know, what you also talked about, like when it comes to tracking and recommendation algorithms and so on social media, like what kind of impact they have on our conversations that we have online. But especially during the last 5 years, I would say Apple specifically have very, very much been very focused on the privacy aspect and really like dialing that up in their marketing as well, and also launching a lot of features related like app tracking transparency and these sorts of things that are very related to this topic, right? Like giving users a better insight into what's going on when it comes to both recommendation tracking but also ad tracking as well.
Yeah, I think in many more years we're gonna look back at the time when this was a big differentiator for Apple and how they used it in marketing as a thing. And we're going to laugh at it because it's so funny that this is like this big thing. Oh, hey, you get privacy here. How awesome is that? And it should just be the default. And fortunately, it has been moving in that direction. Things change very slowly. You see a lot of companies using it as just marketing. And I'm not even going to claim here that Apple is perfect in that regard. There definitely have been problems with the way they do things. But I think in general, they've been putting their money where their mouth is, right? They've been doing the thing they say they're doing and providing people with tools, not just for privacy, but I think also a shift that's been happening within Apple, and I think other companies as well, but we see this more from Apple these days, is also in terms of safety and the tools, like if you are in a relationship where someone is watching over your shoulder while you do on your iPhone, there's like the quick exit thing in settings where you can wipe everything and basically block someone from your Apple stuff if they've been harassing you or something. So I think that's also a good shift, because a long time ago when the iPhone was first introduced, they didn't expect probably how important these devices would be in people's lives. And nowadays, they are very important, and these sorts of tools are very important to have as well, so that people can be kept safe, even if they want to have the convenience of these devices, but not have all of the convenience by giving away all of your privacy and safety.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like that's another kind of general trend, is to give users more control over these sorts of safety features, and also related to privacy as well, right? Like, especially on Apple devices now, which are the devices we primarily use, you have a lot of usually settings for, you know, do you want to enable, for example, ad recommendations and personalizations, or do you want to block that, or, you know, having different safety features in social networks and so on, which is, of course, great to have. So it feels like, in general, like the awareness of that these features are needed, and like you said, the awareness among users that that these things exist when it comes to the algorithms and things like that, and how things are recommended to us, definitely has been a huge trend, I would say.
Absolutely. So what would you say changed in the past 5 years?
So I'm going to kind of move now to a little bit more kind of personal, what has changed for me personally when it comes to the code I write and the work that I do. And I think if I think about the code I write kind of on a daily basis, one major shift that has happened, not just for me, but for a lot of people in our community, is kind of a more strong focus on what we would call declarative programming, and also bringing in a lot more functional programming concepts into kind of the mainstream. So when it comes to both declarative and functional programming, those things have been around for literally decades, right? Like, these are not new concepts, and they've been around for a long time. But in the world of, for example, iOS development or app development in general, perhaps haven't been as much in the forefront and have been more things that more kind of enthusiasts have been using, right? Like, I remember the first time I saw like a map function in Objective-C like many years ago. I thought it was so cool. Like, what a cool concept to take an array and transform it into another array. What a thing, you know? And of course, now in Swift, I think most Swift developers use map all the time, right? Yeah. And it's not just something we use for arrays. It's like a pattern we see all the time. So I think these kinds of concepts have really been lifted to the forefront. And of course, with the launch of both Combine and Swift UI a few years ago, declarative UI programming and declarative data pipelines are becoming also a lot more mainstream. And for me personally, something I've started embracing more and more, even outside of using those frameworks, where it's sort of, we've talked about it before on the show, but it sort of made me shift the way I think about code in a general sense, not just when it comes to UI development or building Combine pipelines. And I think that has really been kind of a big shift for me personally, when I just approach writing code and designing systems to think more about these kind of declarative concepts of how can I structure things in a way that is more kind of declarative, more kind of pipeline driven, more like driven by state, and how can I then apply these functional concepts and maybe not go overboard and just like write everything completely functionally, but use a lot of the power that comes from functional programming when it comes to data transformations, kind of generally when I write code.
Yeah, I noticed this as well about my work, which is something I wouldn't have expected me to do, because I'm usually a bit more skeptical about these, not new paradigms, but when they become more popular in the framework or the platform that I'm working on. And I've noticed, especially like the past couple of years, this pipeline way of thinking, and we talked about this in the show before, how I rewrote some parts of my apps to use that pipeline approach and do like a DSP type thing in AirBuddy to shove bytes between different processes and things like that in a way that can be more testable and easier to reason about. And I've also been doing a lot more unit testing than before, and I've never been a huge advocate of unit testing and TDD and things like that. But more recently, I've been doing quite a bit of unit testing. Whenever I have a problem that I solve that seems a bit more complex than it sounded like in the beginning, which is like 99% of the time, and I had to actually write some algorithm and do a little bit more complicated stuff in there, I see it working and I think, well, this is probably going to break at some point. So I should probably right. write unit tests. And I especially like the freedom they give you to refactor things. If you have good unit tests and you know that they're solid, you can move things around and completely rewrite the guts of things. And you just run the unit tests, and if they pass and they're good, you know that things are still working and you haven't broken everything. And I think in general, the quality of the codes ends up being a lot higher. And also, it really gives you a lot of peace of mind to know that things are still working after a big refactor. So I've become more of a fan of doing unit tests. I'm still not doing them for absolutely everything, and I don't do the crazy tests that some people do where they test absolutely everything or like take screenshots and compare them electronically to make sure the screens match perfectly. I think that's a bit overkill for me. But unit tests for algorithms and data models and things like that, I'm a huge fan these days.
Yeah, I think like those kinds of tests that are more kind of on the UI level or when you're really verifying details very specifically like that are more useful when you're working in a larger team where yeah. you more or less want to protect against certain changes. Like when you have, for example, a UI component library, it can be very useful to like draw all the components, like the standard ones from the UI toolkit you have in your company, take a screenshot and then verify that that screenshot doesn't change, right? Because right. otherwise, it's very easy, especially when you have a lot of people working on the code base, that you have some regressions where someone makes a seemingly unrelated change in like the theme engine or something, and it ends up breaking one of those shared components in a way that maybe isn't obvious because it's maybe it's like a specific configuration only that gets broken. So I do understand why a lot of teams use those kinds of tests when they're a little bit larger and they have those that kind of code that they kind of need to be a little bit more protective around. But definitely when you're working either on your own or in a smaller team, that's something that can definitely feel a little bit unnecessary, or maybe it's not worth the investment you would have to make in order to actually build and maintain those sorts of tests. Even if you're using some kind of library, it's still something you have to maintain and think about as you make changes over time, right? And right. when you're working maybe in a smaller team, maybe you want to optimize more for the speed of iteration rather than being very protective of your code.
Yeah, right. And I used to think of unit tests like that as well sometimes when I was working by myself, that maybe it's not worth my time doing all of this because it's just me and that sort of thinking. But then as you have a product that matures and has more users and you do something and it breaks something and you were completely unaware of the breakage because you didn't have any tests and your manual QA didn't cover that, then you start to think, well, maybe this time I'm losing here by releasing patches and having to do like these quote emergency fixes would be better spent doing automated testing of some sort.
And way less stressful, right? So like right. you don't have that like, oh, I have to get this release out now. Like I have to just like cancel all my plans and just make this hot fix. Like that is not a great situation to be in.
Yeah.
And I want to ask you also, like, do you feel like the fact that, like you said, you have also been changing the way you approach kind of code and writing code in a more kind of functional slash declarative fashion, do you think that's also a reason why you feel like unit testing is more useful to you? Because for me personally, when I started many years ago to think a lot more about unit testing when I write my code, and I'm trying to write code in a very testable way. And when you do write code with those patterns, like with functional patterns, for example, you kind of end up with very testable code by default. So do you also feel like the fact that your code is probably a lot easier to test now is also a big reason why you have embraced unit testing more?
Yeah, definitely. I struggled a lot when I first tried to apply unit testing to back in the day when I was working more with iOS apps, where it was very difficult, right? Because some of the patterns used back then that are still in use today, but less, as we mentioned, they are not very easy to unit test. So you end up having to write a bunch of scaffolding around your unit tests. And I was always thinking, like, but what if all of this scaffolding around my unit tests breaks? Then
right.
How do I know that it's the thing that's broken? Or is it like all of this huge amount of stuff around it that I made as a testing harness broke, and now I don't know what's broken, and I'm just gonna spend like a whole day fixing unit tests instead of fixing the actual problem? So that was a big demotivator for me in that case. But yeah, migrating to this more declarative and functional approach, which sounds like we're just throwing buzzwords around, but it's it's actually the case, definitely helped a lot with writing unit tests and being able to write them more easily as well, especially with structured concurrency, which I have a few problems with still. Some of the solutions we've been talking about, some of our pet peeves with async await and things like that in private. We can talk about those in another episode publicly maybe, but in general, I think it's a great improvement to the developer experience, and also when writing unit tests, because doing closure-based stuff, unit testing that was a bit annoying, and reactive style stuff with Rx Swift back in the day and things like that was also quite annoying, but now it's all fully supported by the XC testing framework, which is the one I use. I don't use any external libraries for testing, and being able to just make my test async and just use things in there that are await really helps make things easier, and not having to think about, oh, how am I going to adapt this so that it can be unit tested? It's usually just, I can just use it from my unit test and it just works.
Yeah, that's definitely a huge convenience factor when you don't have to deal with like test expectations and set up all that infrastructure just to be able to call something asynchronous. You can just make your test case asynchronous. Like, it's really, really fantastic.
Yeah.
But you did bring up a good point there, which was to say, like, you know, when we talk about these topics, sometimes it can very much sound like you're just throwing buzzwords around. Like, yeah, I love declarative programming, but what does that even mean? So I just wanted to bring up some like really kind of concrete examples of where I think this style of programming really has helped me personally a lot to kind of make the programs I write more predictable. And if we think about Swift UI, for example, if we think about Combine and Async Await, those three different technologies, they all require us to think extra carefully about what kind of state that we're managing, right?
Right.
Like in Swift UI, you have to be very explicit and say, like, here's at state, here's my, you have to literally say, this is my state, right? Yeah. And in your observable object and so on, you have to be careful about what are my published properties, and just naturally makes you think more about your data flows and more about that, those kind of declarative concepts, and more about mutations as well, which is another thing that functional programming is very strict about, if you think about it in the kind of strict sense that you shouldn't have any kind of side effect mutations. You should have these pure functions that just take input and return output. And then if you think about async await, because of kind of the whole sendable closures and you can't pass data around exactly just how you want, or you can't access exactly what data you want, especially if it's bound to, for example, the main actor and you want to update on the main queue, but then you want to access it from somewhere else, then that all of a sudden becomes an async call because you don't know if you're on the main actor and so on. So that also kind of forces you to think more about your data and your state in a different way, right? Like in a different context. And then in Combine, because you have that kind of more functional, reactive way of working and thinking, you are also very much encouraged through the framework's API design to think of everything more as atomic operations and functions rather than always passing like self around, which we would do in a more object-oriented way, right?
Yeah.
Where if you try to do that and combine like code in that way, you end up with a lot of just weak self, weak self, weak self, and then your flat maps have to return a concrete value and you end up having to just return a mock value. You know, you end up fighting the framework in a way, and that again kind of makes you think, oh, maybe I can model this in a different way. And you end up very often modeling it in a way that is more testable and is easier to maintain because you have less of that state just being passed around and accessed from everywhere. And that I feel like is kind of concretely what I mean when I talk about adopting more of these patterns and how that has improved my code is not just necessarily like the patterns like when you use them, but it's more how they make you think about things like state and side effects and testability.
Right. And I noticed myself more recently always thinking about state and thinking of ways to eliminate state, because state is the root of all evil, right?
Right.
And it's quite incredible when you make that realization, because even though I joked, it's actually true. If you have a pure function, like we call them, and there's no state, then the number of things that can go wrong is like multiple orders of magnitude smaller, because it's basically the algorithm that you're writing, or maybe you're hitting some system API that can go wrong or something like that. But in general, it's when you introduce state that things start to break down and become more difficult to test and to be able to reason about. So I catch myself way more these days writing something and then noticing ways around state, basically, so that I can do something that I thought required state, but then I notice, oh, but maybe if I just chain these two async things together, I can avoid having to store this somewhere and then unwrap it later and things like that. So I catch myself doing that a lot more these days, and I think it's a good exercise to have when you're programming. And if you can eliminate that as much as possible in general, your life is going to be way easier, both for testing like we were talking about, but also in reducing the amount of bugs you encounter.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's throw another buzzword in here while we're just using all the buzzwords, and that is single source of truth, right?
Right.
And that's another thing that I've really started to think about way more in the last 5 years or so. For example, one pattern that I've started to really notice and almost become allergic to whenever I see it, when I ever find myself writing this kind of pattern, is when you have multiple optionals that basically are just together. Like they are either both going to be nil or they're both going to have a value. Like I always want to find a way to encapsulate that somehow inside like either a struct or even just a tuple or something, to have that single source of truth. Because otherwise I know I will at some point have a bug where I only nil checked one of the values and it turned out that the other one was not what I would expect, or they ended up not in sync. But if I have them together and I can just unwrap them once, then that becomes much easier to deal with. So I think also when you're working with state, I think encapsulating it in a nice way is also a big part of this process, because we can't eliminate all the state from our applications, but we can find ways to manage it in a nice way.
Yeah, and I love that Swift gives us so many tools to deal with that, be it tuples or optionals in general. I'm a huge fan of Guard. Guard is like, I think, my favorite feature of Swift, which is probably available in some other languages, but Swift was the first language that I used that has that feature. And I'm a huge fan of exit early as well, instead of doing a bunch of nested if statements, which I think most Swift developers are also more in this team of doing early exit. And the ability to have a statement in the language that guarantees that I will not keep going if this thing is not true or if I need to exit early is just amazing. And whenever I write, I still write a little bit of Objective-C or even C code these days. And whenever I do that and I do like an if statement that's supposed to exit early and I forget, I always think like, oh, if only I had guard let and that stuff here, this wouldn't have happened, because I have spent probably several hours of my life debugging issues that were caused by not exiting early from a function when it was supposed to exit early because I didn't have guard.
Yeah, I'm also a huge fan of that keyword. And I think it's such a good communicator also to put that in the beginning of your function. Say, here, I'm guarding against these conditions, right? If these conditions are not met, I'm not going to continue with this function. And I'm also a really big a fan of early returns as well, which is actually kind of funny because I remember, like, I don't know if this is 5 years ago, maybe more like, well, it must be like something like 7-8 years ago, around like when the guard statement was introduced, which I believe came in the second version of Swift, if memory serves, like Swift 2.0. I might have that wrong, but you know, it was quite a while ago now. But it was not in the original release of the language. I do know that it came in a like subsequent version. I think it was 2.0, and I remember like before that, I had lots of debates with people in my teams that I was working with if we should use early returns or not. And some people really didn't like it. Like some preferred like the, you know, pyramid of if statements or, right, you know, indenting a whole function with an if statement in the root, which is something, you know, the guard statement is really meant to kind of solve. But once the guard statement came into the language and a lot of people, you know, started using it, I think a lot of people were convinced that this is a really nice pattern. And nowadays, it doesn't feel like it's much of a debate anymore. It feels like most Swift developers just use guard and it's great.
Yeah, and real-time follow-up, it was introduced in Swift 2.0.
Ah, there we go. I have my Swift versions correct. Right. Maybe that will be like a next thing we can do, is we can have a quiz to see how, if I can name the Swift version when each feature was introduced and how many points I can get.
Joan, the Swift historian.
Right. So, Rambo, if we take a step back from the kind of code level here for a second, what would you say are some of the other ways that you've been changing the way you work during the past 5 years?
It's going to sound funny after we just spent a long time talking about these very nerdy language technical things, but I feel like I've become way less technical about my work and much more UX oriented.
So would you say that that translates to you wanting to spend more of your time working on user-facing features like the UX and the UI? Or is it just kind of, you know, the what you think about when you do research or when you want to learn new things? Is it UX-related? Like, how does that kind of influence your work in a day-to-day basis, would you say, in the past couple of years?
Yeah, definitely in terms of the actual work itself, focusing a lot on that. But we mentioned several times, I think, in this show how I'm more of a fan of developing UI, so I like to write code for UI and not the underlying stuff, but I do the underlying stuff because I have to, basically, especially when I'm working on a project by myself. But in general, like the way I think about solving problems and all that goes into that, so I always keep the user experience in the back of my mind, even as I'm working on like the guts of something that don't necessarily translate to UI that the user is going to interact with. But in general, like the whole way I think about my projects and when I'm thinking about features and fixes and changes, I always keep that as my top priority. And it's been working for me. I think people in general like to use the stuff that I make because of that. And I definitely need to improve in many ways when it comes to that. But I think that focus has really helped me, especially since I work as an indie developer. I need to keep that in mind because I'm not just writing codes. I'm also like a product person and marketing person and everything else. So that's really important.
Yeah, you have to wear many hats, right?
Correct.
So we've talked about this before, but I think for me as a developer, like it was kind of liberating in a way, or it made me more excited about working more on my own kind of UX tasks and coming up with designs and so on, when designs for iOS apps went from being these kind of very pixel perfect skeuomorphic designs that required a lot of kind of Photoshop skills and like artistic skills to come up with all those textures, to being a little bit more quote unquote flat, or rather more kind of, you know, using controls and using typography and spacing and these sorts of things as a way to create great designs. And that's not to say that design now is super easy or something. It's just different, right? Like it's right, a different kind of skill set now that you need to have to be a good designer. And I am still not a great designer or anything like that, but I feel like it was very empowering to kind of feel like I could do it and I could learn more about it and I can improve the way I do my designs because I know how to create typography and I know how to change spacings and margins and these sorts of things. And I am not that great with Photoshop and creating textures and rich kind of UIs with very skeuomorphic designs, that is not something I can really do, and not something I'm super interested in either, personally. But in the beginning, I think, like, if you look back now at iOS 7 or something, it doesn't look very fun, right? Like, it looks, like, very much too far that other direction. And now I feel like we've kind of settled in the past, let's say, 5 years or so, into something that is kind of this modern take on the kind of quote-unquote flat design that is not super flat anymore. It has a little bit more flavor and texture to it, but still it very much follows as that, you know, you're using this design system from Apple as the baseline. For example, on the Mac, you're using like all the UI controls and things you would find in a Mac app, and then you're kind of building your own designs on top of that. And I think that you are doing a fantastic job with that in AirBuddy, for example, and the other apps you work on, where they really feel like an extension of the system. And that also, for me, again, as a programmer, is something I feel is way more approachable for me to do, like extending an existing design system rather than coming up with my brand new, you know, original design system from scratch.
Yeah, it definitely became more approachable with the switch to this more flat design, as we call it, even though, like you mentioned, it's not really flat anymore. I think iOS 7 went too far in the other direction, and most people would agree and agreed back then. Have you seen, John, a screenshot from iOS 7 recently?
I have, and yeah, it didn't age well.
No, definitely not. So it was very weird. And but it was exciting because, yeah, it's a big shift in direction. And I definitely think it has become more approachable to people who are not experts in Photoshop or Pixelmator or doing like these really complicated textures and things like that. And I think it was also necessary. And I think a lot of criticism we see these days about, oh, software used to be more reliable and there used to be more craftsmanship in software design back in the day. I think a lot of that is not considering how much more complex software is these days. Because back in the first iPhone, I could spend a month working on getting the perfect leather texture for my navigation bar because it only had to work in a single screen size, single pixel density. And there was also not an expectation that users would, let's say I'm writing like a to-do list app. There was no expectation back then that this to-do list app would have to be on iPhone, iPad, Mac, Apple Watch, the Apple AR headset next year or something. And there was also no expectation that this app would have to sync between all of these devices and also have a web UI and also be end-to-end encrypted and take care of privacy and respect GDPR. And like, things are just way more complicated these days. So this shift, I think, was necessary because if things still were as they were back then these days, I would not be able to make an app by myself because I wouldn't be able to make like all of these textured windows and things and support all different screen sizes. It's already hard enough with the quote flat design. Imagine with all of the textured stuff. And that's not to say that I didn't enjoy those times. If you look around for older stuff that I have on my... It's probably still on my GitHub, and I will probably be ashamed of it if I see it, but feel free to go dig in my GitHub history. But I remember I had lots of little toy projects for macOS with like different textured window styles and different themes windows that were semi-transparent and things like that. So I really enjoyed doing that sort of work. But I think it was a necessary change in design to support like the modern era where you need to support all of these different screen sizes and pixel densities and device hardware and all of the more advanced features that used to be a plus in apps. Like, oh, this to-do list app can sync between your iPhone and your Mac. That used to be like a big deal. Wow, it syncs. And nowadays it's like, whoa, it doesn't sync? This app is broken. Like
exactly.
Yeah, so it's a big shift in priorities and in what people expect from even a, quote, basic app.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's definitely something to be said for that app development has become a lot more complicated, right? Like, it's... User expectations, the number of devices we have to support, like you said, the amount of different features that are really kind of table stakes definitely are complicating things. But I think another like big thing there is that apps these days are expected to be very adaptive, not just to kind of user preferences or devices, but like the context they're being used in. Let's take, for example, like a modern iOS app that kind of ticks all the boxes, if you will, like should it supports all of the features that the system offers. You should then implement, like, depending, of course, on the app and the category and what it does. But let's just say, you know, an average app might need a widget and a live activity and then support for Spotlight and support for these sorts of things, support for shortcuts. And then you add all the screen sizes and the user settings and the syncing and all of that on top of that. So I think like the fact that we need to build apps that are feeling more, they adapt to the context being rendered in and users want to use apps in all of those different contexts, that is definitely something that also really complicates things. And it's also really fun.
Absolutely. And we're probably moving to soon, on top of all of that you mentioned, apps will have to work in 3D space. And also all of them are going to have some AI or machine learning of some sort.
Exactly. And in fact, let's jump over to that now. And of course, right, we didn't cover all of the things that have changed in the last five years. Like, that would be impossible to do in like around half an hour of recording, right? Like, yeah, this was more like talking about what we felt like, what we have changed when it comes to our own work and the way we kind of approach it from kind of a very high level perspective, right? Of course, it's always fun to think about what has happened in the past couple of years and kind of what we can learn from that.
Yeah.
But let's now then flip the coin and talk about the next couple of years, the next 5 years, how we think that might unfold. But before we do, let's take a very quick break here to thank this episode's sponsor. This episode of Stacktrace is sponsored by Essential Developer. Now, something that Rambo and I both get asked very often is, how can you level up your skills as a developer to reach a more senior position? And while there are a ton of code-level resources out there, for example, from Stack Overflow to tutorial websites to articles like mine, finding a place that will teach you all of the skills that are required to become more senior is just really, really tricky. That's why we are so excited to help promote Essential Developer, because they do just that. They've got a free course called the iOS Architect Crash Course, which is all about helping mid-level developers from around the world take that step to become complete senior developers. They will teach you hands-on how to refactor and maintain code over time, how to avoid common anti-patterns, how to utilize concepts like composition, how to design architectures for a project, and much, much more. The course is held 100% online so that you can attend it from anywhere around the world, and it's completely free. So if this course sounds interesting to you, then I really recommend checking it out at essentialdeveloper.com/stacktrace. But don't wait too long, because this course is only available at limited times. So simply head over to essentialdeveloper.com/stacktrace to help support the show, to check out the course, and to sign up for free. Thanks a lot to Essential Developer for sponsoring this episode of Stacktrace. All right then, Rambo. So now then, let's talk a little bit about what do we think might happen in the next 5 years when it comes to our personal work and the way we develop apps and the way we use and interact with technology. What do we think will be some of the kind of big themes that we will see over the next few years?
Well, let's continue on the topic from before. And I think one of those things is definitely going to be machine learning and what is commonly called AI, even though I don't think any of the stuff we see these days is really AI, but that's the more general term, and I think it's a lot easier for people to say than machine learning. So yeah, I think in general, this shift to these more ML-driven systems is definitely a thing that's going to stick around. I don't think it's just a fad that's going to just go away in a couple of weeks. It's definitely a buzz right now and a hype, but I think the hype is real.
Right. And I feel like also there are different kind of generations of ML systems or AI. And of course, AI sounds way cooler, right? Artificial intelligence. Right. And I think the way kind of people usually differentiate between quote unquote real AI is to call it AGI, right? Like artificial general intelligence. But anyway, I think there are different generations of it. And we can see it now with ChatGPT, for example. It's like, it feels like really like a next generation compared to something like the recommendation algorithms that we talked about earlier, or even compared to the digital assistants we have in our phones, which I don't want to say the name because I don't want to trigger anyone's devices, including my own. But it really feels like a huge leap forward, right? And I'm just thinking how many of those kind of leaps we will experience in the next 5 years, whether or not that will actually take us to AGI, that's a really, really big question mark, right? And, you know, how kind of intelligence do these systems really get, and what kind of problems then can it be used to solve? That's another big question. And you know, there are also a lot of kind of cultural questions that need to be solved around that as well. And kind of how do we apply these systems in a way that actually solves more problems than it creates, right? That's going to be a very big thing, I think, for the next 5 years. But the more I think about it, and the more I see these systems kind of develop and these new generations of system coming out, I'm starting to feel like maybe like in the next 5 years or so, it will be almost, I don't want to call it a required skill, but I think a lot more developers will need to work with these technologies than currently. Because currently, like, the domain of machine learning has been kind of its own little community, right? Inside of the software development community in general. It's like, if you're working with machine learning, that's kind of a specialization right now. But if you think about it in terms of kind of app development, app developers in general are expected to be kind of broad in their skill set. Like, if you work on an iOS app, for example, you're expected to be able to work on the database layer and the networking layer and the UI and the animations and so on and so forth. And I feel like AI might just become, or ML might just become, another one of those kind of boxes you kind of have to tick, or, you know, it's very useful for you to be able to do things with machine learning because it will be so common to integrate that into so many different projects.
Right. And something that I'm particularly interested in is the shift to own device for these technologies, which I think is going to be very tricky for many of these things we're seeing now. I have played around with Stable Diffusion and running the actual model on the neural engine in order to generate images on my Mac without having to call a server. And I am personally very interested in own device machine learning. My main concern about these advances is that, and the way that pretty much most apps will have to have some sort of machine learning in a while, is that it's all going to be done by calling some server. And I am not against doing that for certain applications, but the problem is that I think that can become yet another vector for user data being shared without their knowledge, or at least without their explicit consent, with third parties, and especially very centralized third parties. So imagine, like, in a year, every app pretty much calls some OpenAI API. Like, I have nothing against OpenAI as a company, absolutely not. But I think if every single app pretty much starts calling an API from a third party and sending user data to it, it can become a problem, even if it's a non-intentional problem, but if there's some breach or something like that. So as someone who works in security more and more these days, I always think about the possibilities of these things becoming a huge vector for exploiting users in a bad way from a bad actor. So I'm way more excited about what can be done on device now that these devices are so powerful. And I'm in particular very interested in what Apple is going to do, because that's the ecosystem I'm using and that's what I develop for. And I, even though, like, we have a CreateML and we have a bunch of really interesting things by Apple and really cool things you can do on device with frameworks they offer these days, I think it's still very limited. And I feel like they should really be focusing on providing us with even more access to this own device capability and basically giving us even more tools to create our own solutions that run on device.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I definitely prefer on device as well. And I perhaps have a little bit more optimistic take about this. I kind of feel like, because you know me, Rambo, I'm always the optimist, right? I do feel like more and more things will actually move on device over time. And that's because, well, number one, I think the accelerators that we have in our devices, like the neural engine, for example, on Apple's platforms, is just going to become more and more powerful to the point where it just really makes sense to run things on device for latency reasons and also for just economy reasons. Because if you run your models on each user's device, that is server time you don't have to pay for, right? Yeah. And these things can be really expensive to run when it comes to especially these more sophisticated AI systems and machine learning models. That can take a lot of compute power. And the way I'm kind of sort of thinking about this is, you know, if I think about the GPU that I have, well, both in my MacBook Pro, but also in my gaming PC, like those GPUs now locally are capable of producing some incredible graphics in real time, which just like a decade or two ago were only possible to achieve server side in kind of a render farm, right? Like just running offline with, like, you know, overnight or maybe during a few weeks to render these kinds of graphics, right? If you look at like the first couple of computer generated movies that came out, like the real time graphics we have now running at like 120 frames per second look better, right? Yeah. So I think that same thing could happen to ML as well, where once the accelerators become so good, which they will, then, and they are embedded in every single device, there is a lot more possibilities to run on device, and there are some really practical reasons to do that.
Yeah, the economical aspect is what makes me optimistic as well about this, because yeah, it's going to be very expensive if everyone is going to have to be running these servers and or using like the centralized API, which is something you have to pay for. So yeah, I even though I sounded pessimistic about it, I also think that this is going to be possible. And I basically, what I mean is that I want Apple to do for ML and also for the virtual and augmented reality that we're probably going to talk about soon, do the same they've done for things like UI development. And this has been a theme that I talk about a lot way back in the day for, I think, the first edition of WWDC by Sandel. I wrote about ARKit and how it's really cool, but it's still very hard for developers to make stuff for a 3D environment. And it has become better as time goes by and needs to improve a lot. So I want them to make it approachable for developers to make apps that employ these accelerators, and also, of course, for the 3D stuff we're going to talk about, so that it's not a thing that requires like a huge investment and a team of specialists in order to have a really cool application of ML and AI. And I think we're getting there. Like, I'm not saying that we're not in that direction. I think we are moving in that direction. And yeah, it's really exciting. I'm just anxious to see that happen.
Yeah, me too. I definitely want to see like the packaging of these technologies, right? In a way that is more approachable. Because yeah, to your point, that's really what you need in order for it to become something that everyone feels kind of encouraged to learn. Like we talked about in the terms of design before, right? That I didn't feel like that was something I could do back in the day. And right now, or at least like 5 years ago or something, machine learning was something that is not very approachable. Now it's better, but it can get even better still, where you could start with some kind of building blocks, build something that is working, and you can actually utilize these technologies in your app for solving your problems. But then you can find ways to dive deeper and kind of customize things, train your own models, and so on and so forth. And like having that curve, right, that learning curve is really important, I think, for everyone to feel kind of that this is something that they can approach and actually utilize in their projects. I just really hope that Apple kind of is something they continue to focus on. And also, like, I feel like it's time to really step on the gas to not get left behind when these AI models are really evolving so quickly. Like if you compare Stable Diffusion and ChatGPT, like that new generation of machine learning systems, to even something like the digital assistants we have, or the ML models that are kind of the systems and the things that are offered out of the box, I feel like that is already feeling like it's a generation behind of what's now coming out. So I'm really hoping that come WWDC and Apple keeps kind of investing in this area and gives us new technologies that feel like they are kind of the state of the art, right? That they feel modern and they feel as capable of something you would get from OpenAI or some other kind of platform.
Yeah, I think the main difference is that Apple doesn't develop these things publicly as most of these companies do. So we never know what's around the corner, really. We have rumors and things like that, but we never really know what's around the corner. And personally, I'm not very optimistic that we're going to see any big change or any big announcements this year in that regard. I think they definitely have interesting stuff that's in the works, but I don't think there's going to be any huge change this year. But yeah, I definitely agree that it's interesting how when you use something like ChatGPT, it feels so much smarter than the assistant we have on our devices. Even though it's kind of solving a different problem, like I could see how something like, let's say the assistant gets replaced by ChatGPT now. I think what it would be really great for would be general questions, right?
So, yeah, like looking up information.
Yeah,
right?
What's the age of so-and-so and which year was Guard introduced in Swift? I should ask that to ChatGPT.
Definitely. Like, no more. I found this on the web for you.
Yeah, exactly. Which is what ChatGPT does, basically, because it's been trained on web content, but it's different than just...
More integrated, right?
Yeah, just throwing like a bunch of links in your face. But yeah, I think that stuff, it would definitely be way better. And I think someone actually packaged like a shortcuts thing where you can basically use ChatGPT as your assistant.
That's smart.
Yeah, I think they definitely have a lot of work to do in that area. But I'm interested in seeing what they come up with.
Yeah, and of course, like in general, we always talk about that you shouldn't reduce problems and say, you just do this, right? Just replace Siri with ChatGPT, right? Like, it's not that easy, right? Like, like you said, they are different domains, they're solving for different things. But what I'm talking about is kind of, again, coming back to that user expectation, right? Like, if you can go to Bing Search, for example, which is now integrating these technologies, and you would just get that, like, vastly more intelligent feeling conversation with that bot compared to talking to your digital assistant on your phone, that will in the end become a problem, right? Like there will be a disconnect there between those user expectations.
And real-time follow-up, I just asked ChatGPT which version of the Swift programming language introduced the guard statement. And ChatGPT wrote, the guard statement was introduced in Swift version 2.0, which was released in 2015. And he even went on to explain like that previously you would use if let and things like that. So yeah, it got it right.
Wow, that's amazing. Super cool. All right, so the kind of AI revolution, if you can call it that, like it's definitely something ongoing and we'll definitely see it continue, I think, during the next 5 years. But then the question is, will there be also an AR revolution? That is, will we all start wearing AR goggles and do our work that way or interact with content in that way or watch movies, play games, whatever, attend meetings. Rambo, how do you feel about this now as of March 2023? Do you feel like in the next 5 years, like AR, VR, these technologies will become more mainstream and something that we will more integrate into our actual work rather than just like, you know, using the Oculus Quest or using the PlayStation VR to play games, for example? Do you feel like this is going to happen?
I still have a hard time imagining it as a mainstream thing, and especially as like some people imagine that it would be something you'd wear like an Apple Watch. Of course, that will be technically possible at some point on an infinite time scale, but not even that infinite. On a finite time scale.
So in the next 500 years or 5,000 years, not 5 years.
Yeah, not that many, but yeah, that will be technically possible. I just don't see it happening because I think there are so many downsides to it. And also, I'm always thinking about... I think we would both agree, and most people who listen to the show would agree, that the iPhone changed the world, right? So it completely changed the way people interact with technology and content and other people and banking and dating and catching a taxi ride. So it completely changed everything. And we weren't talking, like, a year before Apple introduced the iPhone, we weren't talking about how there's going to be this thing next year that's going to change the world. But we're doing that with these AR and AI and VR and stuff like that. And people talk about how this is going to change everything. And I just don't see it happening. And I think we're right in being excited about it. And I think it's definitely going to have more uses going forward. And it's definitely going to have more adoption going forward for different areas that it's not currently very used for. I just don't see it being like the next big thing. I just don't see that. But I could be wrong. I don't know. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, I think that is kind of the problem with all these debates, right? Is that everyone is always looking for what is going to be the next big thing. And of course, people have always been thinking about that in terms of technology, like what's going to be the next cool new thing that's going to be launched. But I think with the smartphones and with the iPhone and so on, it was kind of this iterative process, right? If you look at it over time, like the next product built upon the previous one. Like the iPhone was not the first smartphone. I had a smartphone before the iPhone from like Sony Ericsson or something, running the Symbian OS, which was not great.
Java.
But I could do stuff with it, and it was really cool for the time. And of course, the iPhone, like you said, it changed the world. It was this like very big leap in terms of like what it could do and so on. But I feel like the same thing kind of also needs to happen to other kinds of products. Like the Apple Watch, when it first came out, a lot of people weren't really sure what to do with it, right? Like how to use it. And Apple, it felt like, wasn't really sure what people would use it for. And then kind of settled with like, oh, it's great for fitness and notification and so on and so forth over time, right? And I feel like the same thing kind of needs to happen if AR is going to be a thing, that it also needs to have that iterative process. And I feel like the problem here is that a lot of us were kind of waiting for this keynote from Apple where they will just launch this revolutionary product from nowhere, and it's going to be these glasses and we're all going to wear them and it's going to change the world. But that's probably not going to happen. Like what's probably going to happen, or what's more likely, is that a device comes out. It maybe doesn't change the world immediately, then, which is an AR device, right? And then the next version comes, the next version, and then eventually either Apple or someone else kind of cracks the code, like with the iPod for MP3s, like with the iPhone for phones. Maybe it will be Apple again that will do it. Maybe it will be some other company that will figure it out, but it will become like the iPod of AR. But first, we need the little MP3 player of AR, or the Symbian OS of AR, right? Like we need those iterative steps, I feel like, before the big revolution happens.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And thinking about the iPhone again, it changed the world in hindsight because, right as it was announced, it was super exciting and people were very excited about it. But it's not like, oh, Steve Jobs left the stage and you go outside and everyone has an iPhone now and it changed the world. It's not how it works. It took several years, but of course, it started with the initial release. But it could definitely happen with this sort of technology. I'm still skeptical about it being a day-to-day thing like a smartphone is for us these days. I think it might be feasible when it becomes a thing that can be where you can wear it as glasses and it's basically like wearing eyeglasses and that's it. I think if it comes to that, it might become more interesting as a thing you're going to use throughout your day. But I personally, I'm way more excited about the possibilities of health stuff happening with the Apple Watch, such as like the glucose monitoring stuff, like the non-invasive glucose monitoring that's been rumored for a long time and could happen at some point. I think there's still a lot of health-related things that these smartwatches can help people with that are not really being explored right now. 3D stuff, living in a 3D space is just not that exciting for me as we speak. But of course, if Apple announces the thing, I'm probably going to buy it just to see what it's like and to I don't know, make everybody for AR or something. But yeah, I am interested in the technology. I'm just not seeing it as this big thing yet. But maybe I can be persuaded otherwise.
Yeah, I'm just super curious to see what Apple's first move will be. Like, because it seems like from every single rumor and report and everything that something is going to happen, probably even this year. So I'm just curious to see what is it going to be. And I really am keeping my expectations low as well. I wouldn't say I'm necessarily skeptical, but I don't expect to get like eyeglasses immediately that I can just go out and wear on the street and see, you know, an augmented reality layer on top of everything and, you know, stuff like that. I'm more thinking, you know, maybe it's going to be something where you can wear like goggles when you're working and you get this huge screen in front of you, multiple screens in virtual reality space, and you can use that as a productivity tool. Just something that sounds interesting, right, to explore. I don't know if it's something I would want to wear like for 8 hours a day, but well, let's find out, right? Like that's the fun part of technology for me is exploring these new things that come out to see how can you integrate them into your workflow to see, you know, will it make you more productive or will it not? That's kind of the fun stuff. So yeah, just keeping an open mind and just very curious to see what will the first step be here. But I'm definitely not expecting a huge revolution, maybe not even in the next 5 years. I think it will, like I said, be a much more iterative process.
Yeah, what it's gonna be is really interesting. And that's, I think, the main thing that keeps me very interested in this project by Apple, because the main use of these sorts of devices these days is for gaming, right? It's
right.
People use them to play games. And of course, whenever Apple announces their own thing, they are going to talk about gaming and show a lot of games, but we know that nobody is going to be buying these to play games.
They're going to show Resident Evil Village and No Man's Sky again, which both of them do have VR modes now, by the way, so they could definitely be showing them.
Yeah, so but nobody is going to be buying an Apple product for playing games. That's just the reality, unless there's like a major change in focus within Apple and across the industry, that's not gonna happen. So what is it that we are going to be using this device for? I think that's the thing that Tim Cook or whoever is on stage talking about this product will need to convince me is like, here's something that Rambo can use this product for that is not gaming, because I don't play games that much and I definitely wouldn't buy an Apple product just for playing games. So I don't know, use numbers, spreadsheets in 3D or Xcode. I don't know. So convince me of something I can use this device for that is not gaming. And that's what I'm really interested in. Like, what's going to be the big use for this device that's not gaming? Because we know that gaming is not going to be the main use of this device, even if Apple says it otherwise.
Right. I love that you're more excited about using a number spreadsheet in VR than playing a game.
So actually, I was being ironic. I was using that as an example of something. That's a very Tim Cook thing to say.
Right. I'm sure Tim Cook is very excited about infinite spreadsheets in a virtual world. All right. So let's do one more before we wrap up today. What do you think is one more kind of thing, either for us kind of on a personal level or more kind of wider in our community, that's going to change in the next 5 years? Of course, again, we can't cover everything here in this episode, but what do you think is kind of one more thing that you think might happen?
Still in the Apple ecosystem kind of scenario, I feel like we're probably going to see Apple doing stuff that we would say, oh, Apple would never do that. And in a good way, I think. Even though it's probably going to happen not because they wanted it to, but because they've been forced to do something. And I'm talking about the general dislike, especially of governments, but also other companies, of how Apple has been running the ecosystem and the limitations Apple imposes on people who want to play within their ecosystem. And especially around freedoms that we don't have when using the Apple devices, such as the ability to sideload apps, the ability for companies to sell you things within apps that don't use their own payment system, that sort of stuff. But I think the first change we're going to see is probably USB-C on iPhones, right?
Right.
As soon as this year, maybe, with the Pro line. But I'm curious to see what sort of thing is going to happen in that area. And if something like that does happen, like let's say they do open up some sort of sideloading on iOS, which sounds like a big deal to many people, but to me, like, it's not that big a deal. And I don't think it would mean much at the end of the day for most users and most developers. And it's just not going to be that big a deal if they do it, as people make it out to be. Like, the world is going to explode if you can install an app on your iPhone without going through the App Store. That's how some people put it. But I don't think it's going to be like that. So I'm interested in if something like that happens, how they approach it, how does it work, will it always pop up a dialogue saying this app might kill you or something. Very interested in seeing if that happens, and if it does, how that happens.
Yeah, I definitely am with you there. I think that it's definitely been made out in these different debates that have happened all around the world to be a bigger thing than it might end up being in practice, right? Especially when you hear Apple talk about it, that it's going to ruin the security of the platforms, right? Like, I think there are definitely ways to be found here. And you know, the easiest comparison that everyone likes to make is the Mac, which does enable sideloading, and it does enable, you know, to run all kinds of different sorts of programs, and it generally just all works. There is somewhat, I think, maybe a little bit of a, if you can call it like a floodgate effect, which is that, you know, it hasn't been possible now for a decade plus to do alternative app stores or sideloading and these sorts of things. And maybe when that dam will burst, it will be like a lot of things happening very shortly in the beginning, and it will be a little bit maybe overwhelming, or it will be like a maybe 10 different new app stores come out in the first month, and then you have to figure out which one you want to use and so on. Because when you have a stable ecosystem like, let's say, Windows or macOS, you know, there are lots of quote-unquote alternative app stores, but we don't even tend to think about them like that, right? Yeah. Like when I install a game from Steam, yeah, I'm using an quote-unquote alternative app store, but it just feels natural, right? It feels natural to install a game that way. And I think the same thing over time will probably happen on iOS, but it will probably take a while to get there where it feels, you know, something you might want to use, or it might just be confusing in the beginning. But I think that's all just because you're taking a platform where those things haven't been possible, and then all of a sudden everything becomes possible. Even if that will happen, we don't know. Like, maybe it's going to be more of a gradual thing. Maybe it's going to be more of a thing that it's only available in certain markets because those are the governments that forced Apple to do it. Maybe it's going to be a more limited approach in the beginning, and then it will expand over time, and maybe only one of these things will happen, like maybe only alternative app stores or only sideloading. Like, at this point, we don't know, but I definitely feel like something will happen, like you said, in the next 5 years, because there's just so much pressure, also from developers, I would say, right? Like, yeah. I think that one thing that has changed, even in the past 5 years, is that a lot of developers are now kind of fed up with Apple, right? And feel like, you know, it's gone too far, which is interesting, because if we think about it kind of just by the numbers, in the beginning, I remember when I first started doing iOS development and helping clients publish apps and so on, it was kind of way worse than what it is right now.
Definitely.
You had to wait super long for reviews. You usually got like 4 or 5 random rejections. You had to like bake that into your schedule. You have to think like, oh, let's plan to release this app now, but it will actually come out in a month, because that's after all those reviews and rejections will happen. And if that happens now, it feels like it kind of very often turns into this kind of bigger story. And it's like a, you know, it's something people get upset about, which, again, I understand. I also get upset when I get App Store rejections that I think are unreasonable. So yeah, it's just interesting how this topic has evolved, and also like developer expectations have evolved, where people feel, it feels like in general, don't want to put up with this stuff anymore and just want to be able to ship their apps, which I definitely want to do. And it's a big reason why I, for example, prefer, when I launch things personally, to build things for the web, like my website, for example, where I can just deploy whenever I want. And when I work with clients, of course, I have to very often deal with the App Store and reviews and so on. And yeah, it's definitely a hurdle you have to get over. So let's hope that something happens here, and let's hope it's going to actually be a change for the better.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do feel like many times when this topic comes up, it becomes a thing where people make it out to be this huge deal like we talked about. And I'm slightly disappointed, even as some people within our community, that they just don't listen to people like myself, who, like, I work with security stuff on both the Mac and iOS. I have gotten like bug bounties from Apple, and I know a lot about how the security of these systems works. And I can tell you that allowing people to install apps without going through the App Store is not going to ruin the security of the system. The security of the system does not depend on the App Store. Like, it's just not how the model works. I feel like for some people, they put it out to be like the whole security of iOS relies on people trusting the App Store and App Review doing a security analysis of each app, which is absolutely not what they do. Like, they probably don't even have the knowledge, or even they are probably not even instructed to do that sort of thing in their training, because they don't have to. Like, of course, there are scams and things like that, but that's more of a safety thing rather than a security thing. But in terms of actual, like, security, is this app using an exploit to do something bad on the system? App Review is not preventing any of that, and that wouldn't change with the ability to sideload, and the security of the system would not be impacted in any significant way, in any fundamental way, by allowing people to install apps from another source, because it's just not how the security of the system is achieved. It is achieved through technical means, not through policy.
Right. I feel like one thing that is very connected here is the topic you originally brought up regarding that users are now more aware of recommendation algorithms and so on, and privacy. And I feel like that has all brought with it a lot of skepticism towards software in general, for, in many cases, for very good reasons, right? Because we have now big companies, like big tech companies that are, you know, this, they're supposed to be this, like, reputable, you know, big companies that are doing the right thing. And some of them, you know, they have a little bit creepy practices, right? When it comes to our data and the way they deal with that, and in terms of privacy and so on and so forth. So I feel like that is feeding so much into this as well, where it kind of feels more quote unquote safe to have Apple be actually maintaining this app store and kind of shielding users from these bad actors, if you will. How much of that actually happens in practice? Definitely a big question mark. And also, how will actually sideloading, will that even make it worse? Also very big question mark. So, but I feel like that's kind of where this is all coming from. Or what do you think, Rambo?
Yeah, I think that is a good point. And I think it even helps my own point, because if people are aware of these things and are more skeptical of software, like you mentioned, which I think also is a good thing in general, then maybe they just won't enable sideloading on their iPhone, and they will prefer to still use the App Store, which is what 99.999% of users are going to do. If tomorrow iOS 16 point something enables sideloading, for the majority of users, it won't change anything, because it will probably be something like the new developer mode, where you have to go into settings and enable something and then type your passcode, reboot the device, type in your passcode again to confirm.
Shake it two times, do a little dance.
And then every time you install something that's not from the App Store, you're going to get a warning, or maybe the icon is going to have a big X on top of it or something. most people are just not going to bother. And yeah, there are going to be, like, I don't know, people are going to make TikTok videos teaching people how to enable sideloading to get, like, this cool little game that's not allowed in the App Store or something. And some people are going to do that and are going to have problems because of that. But that's been the case with Android for a while. And I'm not saying that I want to, like, to, quote, lower the security of iOS to the level of Android, because I think Android has other issues that are more on the basis of how things work, not that they allow sideloading. But yeah, you can, on Android, you can go into settings and enable this setting that allows you to install apps from anywhere. And even with something like, I think it was Epic who tried to do that and tried to force, but basically like, if you want to play your game, you have to go into this and enable sideloading and get it from us and not the Google Play Store or whatever. And it just didn't work. and people didn't do it. Some people did. Some people fell for scams that made them download the wrong thing. So yeah, there are problems, but it's something that will not affect any significant number of users, and it would be fine in the end. And I think it will, because I do think this is going to end up happening.
Yeah, and also I want to point out that I think this will have some positive things with it. Like, if we set aside the, will it turn iOS into a more or less secure platform? Will there be problems coming with that or not? And how will that unfold? I think there will definitely be benefits to having a more open platform that people can deploy on more freely, because it also just, I think in general, opens up computing to more people. And, you know, I think about myself, like the fact that I could learn how to code by just writing code and running it on my machine and not have to think about code signing certificates or solid loading and so on and so forth. It was a big reason why I could become a developer in the first place, right? Yeah. And it would be a shame, I think, if we, the people of the earth, let all of our computing platforms turn into this super closed down machines. Like, how then is the next generation of developers going to ever learn how to, build things? So I think that's another thing, just from a kind of philosophical perspective, if you will, or like, yeah, long-term perspective, is to, you know, have open platforms in general, I think, is a good thing, as long as they're managed in a good way.
Yeah, and we have seen cases of apps that were basically almost like too innovative for the App Store, or that they were too out there and too different, or they did something that was not something that Apple expected, basically, in a different way, and not in a bad way, but something cool that basically App Review was like, nope, this is not going to be allowed because it's too weird for us, basically. And then those projects just got shut down and never got a chance to exist, basically. And that's really sad. Like, I think there's a lot of innovation that's been prevented by this requirement of having to go through the App Store. I don't think that's like the majority of what happens. I think the majority of rejections are probably for very good reasons, but I do think there is a proportion of rejections that prevented some innovations from seeing the light of day because of some weird Apple rule that they enforce irregularly.
Yeah, there's definitely something to be said that innovation happens mostly in platforms that are as open as possible, or rather, the more open a platform is, the less kind of guardrails there are to actually innovate, right? And to come up with cool things. And of course, you can always innovate in something that is more closed and more constrained, but you can just innovate in some specific fields. And I think that's what we've been seeing in the kind of app era that we're in, if we're going to call it that, since the iPhone launched. Like, the app metaphor, like running things in an app like that, has seen a ton of innovation, right? Like, there's a ton of new apps coming out all the time that do super interesting, cool things. But then when you go beyond that and you think about, you know, you couldn't on iOS, for example, build like a new system component, for example. There's no innovation that could happen there outside of Apple. So that's when you run into those problems, right? And of course, sideloading wouldn't necessarily solve that problem. Question is if we want to take that trade-off as well, because then we really start talking about the security model really being stressed if you're going to be able to integrate your own custom system components and plugins and so on. But it's just go to show that, you know, more openness in this sense will likely lead to more innovation. So I think it's definitely a debate worth having.
Absolutely.
Great. So I think we touched on some interesting points here, both kind of reflecting back during the past 5 years, what has happened for us in terms of our work and so on, and the way we use technology, and also thinking about the future. And of course, we did touch on the big three that I was expecting us to talk about: the AI stuff, AR, and also, of course, Apple and sideloading and the openness of their platforms. I think those are three really big themes for the next 5 years. And of course, there are many, many more things that could happen and other things worth discussing. But, you know, that's why we're not stopping the show today, right? We're going to keep talking. So those were just some things we thought would be fun to talk about today on this fifth year anniversary episode. So I hope you all enjoyed listening to this episode, and whether or not you've listened to this show for just a couple of episodes, or this was maybe your first episode, or you've listened for all the 5 years, thank you so much for listening. It's really awesome to have so many of you listening to us talk about these topics, and it's such a pleasure for us to record these episodes as well. So thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much to Essential Developer for sponsoring this episode. So make sure to head over to essentialdeveloper.com/stacktrace if you're interested in joining their free iOS Architect crash course and also help support our show. But that's it for this episode. So all that remains is for me to ask you to say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.